So, bevor es jetzt gleich losgeht mit dem Podcast, mit dem eigentlichen Podcast, haben wir uns überlegt, eine kleine Einordnung zu machen. Denn die heutige Podcast-Folge findet statt auf dem Emotion Women's Day, powered by OMR. Zum ersten Mal in diesem Jahr gibt es also ein ziemlich großes Side-Event zum Online-Marketing-Rockstars-Festival, organisiert von der Zeitschrift Emotion und ihrer Herausgeberin, Unternehmerin Kascha Mohl. Und ich stehe hier zusammen mit Julia, Michaela und Iris von Philip Morris International. Hallo erstmal.
Hallo.
Hallo.
So now we switch to English. As, Julia, you're from originally from Russia. That's
yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Speaks better English than German. And so please start and give us a little bit of context about the big change your company is going through.
Yeah, actually in the last years we have been transforming our business. Ever since we have started developing the smoke-free products, it has been a totally different story for the tobacco company. Because we are no longer a tobacco company that we used to be for many years. Now we are more a technology and even a little bit of scientific company. We have two R&D facilities in Singapore and in Neuchâtel in Switzerland, where we have over 400 scientists from all over the world working on developing and assessing the reduced risk products.
And you have your mission is smoke-free, or is it true?
Yes, our mission is to switch all adult smokers to better alternatives, which are smoke-free products.
Yeah. So what is your perspective? You're from Germany, from the Munich office. I guess it's one of the largest operations is Germany. So what did change for you over the last months?
Well, in fact, I only joined last year, January, so not even 1.5 years ago. And in fact, the reason why I joined is the fact that Philip Morris is transforming as a company. I always said to my earlier boss from other days, I said I'd never join a tobacco industry or tobacco company. Now I'm working for the world's largest tobacco player, Philip Morris. And in fact, I do it as the company is transforming. And I think it's so interesting to like that a company decides to put everything on one single card and says, okay, we completely disrupt our own business and we want to stop selling cigarettes and want to switch to other products. We call them better alternatives. Like imagine any other company in the world saying, we don't want to sell our main product any longer. And
that's crazy.
In fact, it's crazy. And this is why I was able to join, or I said I will join.
Mm. So, Michaela, maybe you give us the context. Who will be my guest in the podcast?
It's Marianne Salzman, of course.
Absolutely, yeah.
And Marianne, actually, it was very interesting that she joined a tobacco company because she's anti-smoker. But she said, you know, why not? And it is my chance to motivate smokers to quit smoking, or if they cannot, to move them to a better alternative, have less harmful products.
Yeah, and you all three work in the communication of Philip Morris. So mm-hmm. What is the change in your department? What is different than the years before?
Yeah. If I can say, I started 5 years ago at Philip Morris, mm-hmm. and was like 2 or 3 years on paternal leave. And when I came back, you know, it was a completely change in terms of communication. So we went from the reactive company to proactive communication, from offline to more digital. So it's really a completely change in terms of working the communication department.
I think it really matters that we have a lot to proud about. Because in the recent years, we have invested $6 billion in development and assessment of the reduced risk products.
$6 billion
since 2008. And we have a lot of research. The scientific data is really encouraging. And we're willing to share it with the journalists, with media, with the public. And of course, with adult smokers who should have able to make an informed choice. You know, if you have all the data regarding the research and the results, it's easier to make a choice to quit.
Yeah, and we're here at the IQOS lounge at the Emotion Women's Day, and I have to say, it's the best air in the whole building. I don't want to make now advertising for smoking because I'm a non-smoker as well, but I really have to say, a company that decides to leave their old turf, their old product, and entering a totally new space, where the product is 90% less harmful. I think it's a bold movement, and I thank you very much for joining me and for giving our listeners the context to what they will hear now. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Hallo wieder zusammen im Multispace. I'm very pleased and honored to host today this successful podcast of entrepreneur Michael Trautmann with Marian Salzmann. Michael is not only an entrepreneur but also the one of the most important creative person in Germany, founder of the creative agency Think, inventor of a new very challenging sport that's called High Rocks, and one of the most successful podcasters in the country. Marian Salzmann is a world-famous trend researcher, agency head in the USA. In addition, she has already overcome several challenges and serious crises in her life that have also given her strength for her future life. We met once at an ICOS event in Hamburg, and I'm very happy that you're here. We are very much looking forward to hearing from you, and the stage is yours.
So, I think I was never nervous like this to speak in front of so many powerful women. Maybe I was in a room with that many women, but there were 10 times more men. So I really have to start to breathe and to relax a little bit. So, I'm very, very happy, Marian, to have you here. And what Kasia did not tell us, that you are the creator of the phrase metrosexual.
I am the commercializer. I found the phrase, and I wish I could tell you I did it for all the right reasons. There were two things going on. We had a really lecherous guy in our office who would show up every day around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. No one knew if he was gay or he was straight, what he wanted. And we were kept looking for a word to describe him. And so one of my colleagues had gone heli-skiing in New Zealand, and in those days it was a fax. He sent back a fax. He says, I have the answer, and the word metrosexual was circled. So metrosexual, the word, had been used in 7 times in history before I then attached it to a piece of research. The second piece of the story was I had a book coming out on buzz marketing. The year was 2003, and I wanted to prove that if you had the right idea and the right energy, you didn't need a big budget in order to be able to share a concept globally. I never expected to be as effective with the word metrosexual. It ended up being the word of the year. It soon eclipsed me. The poor guy that had originally created the word, Mark Simpson, came out of the woodwork absolutely apoplectic. And in the name of sexism, I'm going to share it with you. He basically went on British TV and said, the reason Marian Salzmann is so effective with the word metrosexual is because she looks like a pretty housewife, and therefore she isn't threatening when she introduces a word like that into society. He was a self-described lesbosexual male, a lesbian in a male body. So he basically said, because I look like a pretty suburban housewife, I wasn't going to be beaten up by the media. So that's a good kickoff to whatever we want to discuss today.
The first man, which was called metrosexual, at least in Europe, was David Beckham. Did he ever say thank you to you?
So he never said thank you. I should say thank you to him for giving me a whole second life of my career. But he did say thank you in that I interviewed him briefly for Time Magazine's People of the Decade. And so at the end of the conversation, he said thank you. So technically, he said thank you.
Okay.
But no,
that's nice.
Say thank you.
So as I told you before, you're a guest at this spectacular conference, but you're a guest in my podcast as well. And my podcast is called On the Way to New Work. And I always start the conversation with the question, how did you become the woman you are today?
So I think a lot of who I am today is a function of the years I was born and where I grew up, meaning I was born into that entire world in the U.S. where your mother had been repressed and therefore her daughters could do anything. When I say anything, all barriers, boundaries, nose were taken away. Schools went co-ed just as I was coming of that age. Sports teams went co-ed, or money became available for women's sports. So I didn't know any better than to just assume I could do whatever I wanted. And I had only one simple aspiration as a child, and that was I never, ever wanted to live in a small suburban town. That was the only thing I was sure of. Like, you would take these like personality tests to figure out what you could be for a career, and I would go to see the guidance counselor and say, yeah, yeah, but how can I make enough money so I never have to live here? So in hindsight, I was very rude, but I just knew I wanted a bigger, broader palette. Ironically, my parents, my father had been in the U.S. military, so he'd been in Japan and in Korea. My mother never had a passport till not the first trip I took overseas, but the first time I stayed for a long period of time. And I don't come from a very sophisticated background. When my parents made their first real trip to Europe, when I was already working in Amsterdam, they didn't know that Gatwick and Heathrow were two different airports. So they booked a connection. It was a disaster that involved me having to But it was really a function of American history. In the 70s, everything was wide open, and you were encouraged, and exceptions were made to be sure that you achieved something.
And how did you find your way out of this tiny place and into the first big city?
You know, I think it was really a matter of I just kept applying for things, and I am fearless about being rejected, so I never counted how many things didn't accept me. I would just say, okay, but I got into this. So, I mean, when I was 14 or 15, I won a trip to Europe to stay in Birmingham, England. Now, there's 1,000 trips I didn't win, but that one kind of opened up my gateway to travel. And then the same thing with going to university. I was just committed to going to an American Ivy League school, so 7 of them rejected me. Luckily for me, 1 of them took me. I didn't get into any of the women's colleges, which is really ironic, because I thought that if I would go to a women's college, I would get a better education, but I didn't get accepted. So I just think it was a function of not caring how many people said no. I was just always looking for the yes.
Yeah, then after university, you made a fantastic career in the agency space. You, some people say you worked for almost every famous agency in your country.
I've only ever worked at 3 agency holding companies. I worked at Chiat Day, which became Omnicom, mm-hmm. and then later on worked at Porter Novelli, which is in their PR space. I worked for Young & Rubicam, which became WPP, and then many years later went back and worked at J. Walter Thompson. And I worked at Havas for over 15 years across, but I've had like 38 different agency jobs. But again, I think that was a function of my gender, because before I'd be ready, they would promote me or ask me to do something else because they kept needing to push women up in management. So I worked only for a few agencies, but I had a lot of jobs within the agencies.
What was the reason, finally, to disrupt your career and to start working for a company which is famous for producing tobacco?
So I'm not a smoker. I'm not interested in smoking. I am the most unexpected global spokesperson for a tobacco company one can imagine.
What is the expected? You told me before.
The expected, I guess I had a stereotype. He was a 50-year-old white guy who was sort of chubby, who'd been smoking a hell of a lot of cigarettes, so he had a raspy voice and everything else. I didn't think of it as anyone like me. In fact, we have a campaign right now called Unsmoke, which is super emotionally important to me, except for I've just been back in the States for 4 weeks, mostly on business, but I'm looking for an American friend to unsmoke, and I don't know any smokers. So, I mean, I'm completely not what you anticipated. So 2 things. I'm a 2-time brain tumor survivor, which you guys kind of alluded to in your introduction. So twice I've had major brain surgery, and both times I've had a really full recovery, which is a function partially in the U.S., of being in good health when you go to get surgery, and partially a function of having good medical insurance. So after my second brain tumor, which is now 7 years ago, you get to the 5-year anniversary when you've had any kind of disease like that, and you're like, oh my God, now I'm going to live. You have to make a whole game plan, because for the other time, you're just waiting for the next shoe to drop. And so I'd passed my five-year anniversary. My husband's kids were now all finally going away to school, so we could finally get rid of that house in the suburbs that I thought of as a weekend home, but they were using for other reasons. I would go to the city Monday to Thursday primarily, but they would stay there. And so Philip Morris called me, and I was like, absolutely not. Are you kidding me? No way. But the lady was really nice, so I said, I'll give you other names. I'll call you back. And I went home, and I was in our apartment in New York City. I was by myself. It was like 8:30 at night. I go online to look up this company called Philip Morris that I thought was this Marlboro company, and the first page was on smoke-free future. And I just started reading it, and it was kind of intriguing to me. And I was still, no, absolutely not. And then my husband is a human rights law professor, so the furthest thing you would think, and so much more, I mean, I'm a liberal, but he makes Bernie Sanders look conservative. That's how liberal. So I call him, and I'm like, you're never going to guess the phone call I got about a job. And I started explaining this, and he goes to me, why did you tell them no? And I'm thinking, oh, have you been hit in the head? Like, what happened here? And so I call the woman back the next day, and I give her the names of these other people. And I said to her, you know what? Like, I'm never going to get the job. I'm an agency person. I'm too liberal. I don't smoke. I went through my whole reasons. I said, put my name in there because I want to be on your good side because I'd like a corporate board. And so she put my name in there, and I completely forgot about it and went back to running my agency at Havas and was very happy and basically thought I would work there for another decade. And like 4 or 5 weeks later, they called, and they're like, they're really intrigued by your CV. And I'm like, I'm not really intrigued by the tobacco business.
About the CV of
course. And then it went to be a dance, and it went on from like August or September until I accepted the job in February. But everyone I met kept being interesting. And I mean, my family was divided between Tucson, Arizona, and New York City. I had already lived in London and lived in Amsterdam. Lausanne, Switzerland was the furthest thing on the planet from a place. So I kept coming up with reasons to say no to them. And they kept calling me back and saying, well, can we just have another meeting? So it was a very bizarre courtship. And yet the minute I walked in the door at Philip Morris, my very first week, I was like, why didn't I take this job 3 or 4 years earlier? So because I would have liked to have been part of the original strategy around smoke-free, instead of I have the luxury of just being there when we get things like the FDA announcement of last week. So it's been great. It's 13 months now. I have no regrets other than Lausanne, Switzerland on Sundays. Good luck doing your food shopping, getting your nails done, going to a library, a bookstore, and Sundays are dead. So I hate my life on Sundays, and everything else is fine.
I had the chance to talk to 4 of your colleagues before, and they are such big fans of you. They said, Michael, she changed everything. I'm working here since 10 years in this company, and she changed everything. What did you change?
So I don't know. I mean, thank you for that, and thank you to them for that. I think the problem is I didn't know why not. So I just assume everything is possible. So I assume that if you come up against a barrier, you zig and you zag. Like, I didn't know people. I knew, this is really a stupid thing I'm going to admit, but I knew I didn't like Philip Morris, but I didn't think the world hated Philip Morris. So every one of my reactions has been, we have a really good story to tell. As soon as I found out more, I became intrigued. So whenever I'm given opportunity to share with people the fact that we want to re-engage with civil and civilized society, I simply say yes. So when we wanted to be part of the World Economic Forum at Davos, and they didn't take our money straight away as delegates, we found another way to do it. We partnered with a media company and went anyway. When people say no, we need to follow the law. So the law is really important, L-A-W. But my job has been to disrupt the lore, L-O-R-E. So I constantly say, what law, or is this lore? And so that's given me a lot of room to push things further. But I also work for a fabulously open-minded CEO and COO and CFO who really wanted to see the company recognized as re-entering civilized society. So it's been pretty easy.
Is it true that they all stopped smoking?
No one smokes. I mean, many of them use IQOS, but it. No, in fact, I asked someone recently, do we have any smoking rooms? Because No, I mean, I think I'm told globally 30% of the company uses combustible tobacco. I'm still looking for anybody who does. I haven't seen anyone. I spoke to a lawyer recently who's being relocated from Lausanne to a place where IQOS is not yet legal. And I asked him what he was going to do, and he said with a lot of fear and trepidation, he's going to start smoking Marlboros again. So that's one person I found, but not yet because he hasn't moved. So no, people, they use IQOS, but they don't smoke.
Cool. So coming back to you as a person, so people say you reinvented yourself with a little bit over 50 years. Do you think it's an exception in our times, or is age no longer a problem today?
So here's the problem. I have this American attitude about age, which is very different, I think, than the... So I'm 60 years old. So I got this letter from the Swiss government on my 60th birthday informing me how many days, weeks, and months I have left before it's illegal for me to work.
So, you're kidding me.
It's like you get this letter and it says you have four, you know, you have 5 years, 14 days. It's like some, I don't speak French, so that's the second problem. Everything's through Google Translate. But I'm giving you basically the factual thing. You get this letter. And for me, it was like, oh my God, now I'm going to go to law school and become a divorce lawyer. Now it's like, because I'm American, so first of all, I'm not really eligible for my limited, and the retirement benefits in the U.S. are terrible, but I'm not eligible to really take them and get your full benefits till I'm 70-something years old. So if they're going to have me leave my job at 60-something, I'll go to law school and I'll become a divorce lawyer, and I'll specialize in divorce for people over 50, and I have a whole nother career. But age is a huge thing. And the other thing I think is really interesting is throughout Europe, people keep wanting to ask me, do you feel like you're too old for your job? The first thing that crossed my mind would be, you ask a man the same dumb question, followed immediately by...
Yes, they would.
I mean, so it's really interesting. Women say they wouldn't, men say they would. I think in the...
I'm 54 and I'm always asked, Michael, yeah, you're retired now. You have so much time, so how do you spend it? It's true, really.
See, retirement is a European luxury.
Yeah.
Retirement is, it's a luxury item that America, I mean, I guess I wish I could have thought about retiring. It's completely, I guess for me, it's sort of out of the question. The flip side of it is, I think coming out of the agency business, it's a very tough business to be first over 40, then over 50. So I always argue that for the first half of my career, they would always ask me to lie about my age, or they would encourage me to always be 30. I was 37 for a decade. And then I sort of became 40, and they would say, oh, you're so lucky, you still look young. And it was like, I was 37 for another decade.
So and like then, Madonna.
Well, I think Madonna is bringing this whole thing to the forefront. I just read in British Vogue this question about her being left out of the rotation on the BBC because the BBC Trust is focusing on listeners ages 15 to 30, and she's past her sell-by date. That's my favorite phrase, past your sell-by date, meaning you're too old to be considered young. So I think Madonna is going to tackle ageism, and a lot of us are going to follow patiently right behind her.
Crazy. What advice do you give young women today for starting their careers? I mean, with just women.
My first piece of advice is stop thinking about a career.
Yeah.
Think about a series of opportunities and know when to take the next challenge. Failure is part of the learning that goes into building something. I never knew I was going to have a career. I just kept chasing interesting things to do and kept learning. And now people talk about my career. I mean, I remember when I was in my 30s, I worked at an agency called Chiat Day, fabulous agency, very creative, very provocative. And my mom came to see me one day, and she said to me, you can't go to work dressed like that, you're going to be fired. She's like, what kind of career person are you? And my mother wanted me to go in a bow tie, you know, one of those female bow tie things and like a suit and all that. And I was going in denim mini skirts and Converse high tops. And she was completely convinced I was going to be fired because of the way I dressed, because I didn't look like a, quote, a career person. And I'm going to say, stop worrying about your career. Just choose the best opportunities. I also say I've never, ever chosen a job based on the job content or the salary. I've always chosen it based on the person I'm going to work for. And I think that's the single most important advice that anyone could give you. If you work for the right person, it's a wide open piece of paper and how you're going to fill your time. And if you work for the wrong person, it doesn't matter how great the salary is or how great the job description is. And I think for me, walking into Philip Morris, I'd say by the end of the second or third week, I knew I had chosen to work for the right person. So I was willing to figure everything else out. And believe me, there's lots of days when I'm like, I don't know enough about science. I don't know enough about agronomy. I am not oriented to be a regulatory person. But because I work for the right person, I'm just willing to carry home the books and the notebooks and figure it out at night and on weekends to learn it.
In the first speech this morning, I was shocked. Very, very good speech, and I learned a figure which said if there is a conference and 30% of the content is delivered by women, people feel that it is aggressively dominated by women. Why is this so? Why do people feel if there is 30% women in the room, it's aggressively dominated? I mean, what did we do wrong?
The world is still a disgustingly sexist place, guys. I didn't know it for the longest time because I had the luxury of coming of age in the U.S. in the 70s and 80s and working in the U.S. When I first got to Europe in 1995, I discovered the world was a pretty sexist place. I'm now discovering, watching what's going on in politics in the U.S., that the U.S. was always sexist, just people were more polite about it. And I was just pretty darn lucky. I think there's something wrong with the fact that if I'm tough on someone, I'm called aggressive. A guy behaving the same way would be called being told they were leader-like. So I think there's a whole language of how we keep women back. So it should be 51% of women should be speaking at conferences because that's the way we fit into the marketplace.
I think we're the best place in the world because here is 95% women speaking, and I think it's a good...
I don't agree with you because for me, the best of all worlds is when gender becomes completely irrelevant and it was 50-50 and we had 50% men in the audience and 50% male speakers and you just had the very best speaker available, but women would have had access to all those opportunities and educational things to be able to be those people. I don't think segregated stuff is the best thing either. It's important to do it now because we don't have other alternatives, but this is not nirvana. This is a work in progress.
Perfect. Time is flying. We have to skip it now. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks,
we'll see you tomorrow and the day after at 1 hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.